Five, four, three, two, one, zero. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
We are talking about the space job market in this episode. My guests are Seika and Brian Mazur, the founders of Ad Astra, a space talent advisory or headhunting firm. Besides talking about the trends in the space job market in general, we also discuss some advice specifically for job candidates and for space company founders. Make sure to listen in.
My name is Raphael Rotkin, and I'm an investor and advisor to space companies. Just as a reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only, and nothing should be taken as investment advice. This podcast is sponsored by NanoAvionics, a satellite manufacturer and mission integrator. Their technologies enable many space companies worldwide to offer services that improve life right here on Earth, such as providing global connectivity, conducting Earth observation, or contributing to scientific discoveries. Check them out, and also check out my episode with their CEO and co-founder. Sadly, I am not a rocket scientist, but I'm an alumnus of the International Space University. ISU offers a number of educational programs about space worldwide. Check them out at isunet.edu.
And just some final things before we start the episode about ourselves. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, such as Apple or Spotify. If you want us help expand our work, you can do so and support us at www.patreon.com/spacebusinesspodcast, and we'll also put that link in the episode notes. And lastly, you can follow us on Twitter at podcast_space.
Hey, space enthusiast, welcome back to another episode of the Space Business Podcast. My guests today are Seika and Brian Mazur from Ad Astra. Welcome, guys.
Thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Cool. Pleasure is all mine. So why don't we start off as we usually start off? Can one of you just tell our audience what you guys are up to?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, personal side, we're husband and wife. We just had a small child. So we have a 7-month-old on our hands. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And at Astra, kind of how it relates to the space industry, we do executive and highly technical headhunting for space startups, specifically space startups. And we also do clean tech startups. So really love to be involved with the technical side and really understand startup culture.
Okay, terrific. And so maybe if we take a step back, and you guys can also talk a little bit about your sort of previous lives before, and like how long you guys have been doing at Astra and what your previous lives were, sort of a summary of that. And then how did you guys decide to do at Astra and what were the main motivations?
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, you want to talk a little bit about your impressive background and how that brought us here to at Astra?
Sure thing. Yeah. I got my bachelor's and master's in aerospace engineering from the University of Michigan. And sometime, maybe freshman, sophomore year, I heard about this crazy guy, Elon Musk, and how he wanted to colonize Mars. And so I was like, that sounds a little more interesting to me than maybe making a Boeing engine 1% more efficient or something like that. So I pretty quickly knew that that's where I wanted to end up, and did some internships at SpaceX and was there full time as well, spanned about 7 years, mainly as a propulsion engineer. And after that, went on to lead U.S. operations for a drone technology startup in the Bay Area. And it was around then that Thicke and I had the idea to start at Astra. I'll let her share a bit about her background, how it all came together.
Yeah, my background is all in talent acquisition. So I started at a boutique consulting firm where we would optimize the internal recruitment function for Fortune 500 companies. These are large established organizations, brand names people know, and we didn't do any recruitment for them, but would kind of come in and say, where are the pain points and what sort of creative solutions can we apply? That's a really fun topic, a rabbit hole that we could go down at some other point, just all the different creative solutions that you can come up with for really strange problems that companies are running into, right, with hiring. And I then went on to work at a CNC distribution company. And that's where I really, first of all, learned what a CNC machine is. And it's also when I got to understand what manufacturing in America was about. I started to get some insight into aerospace manufacturing. And I started a staffing agency specifically for CNC machinists, CNC programmers. Those are people you can't find on LinkedIn, right? Or every once in a while you can find them on LinkedIn, but you got to look in a lot of other creative places. And it really sparked my love for creative creating strategy for finding hard to find people. And so then I went on to work at another kind of legacy nationwide organization and worked with a couple early stage startups. And then it kind of all came together where it was all Brian's idea. Brian came to me and was like, hey, we've got all these friends in our network who are coming from SpaceX, right? And they're like starting these incredible startups and they're saying they need to find the best talent. And like, this is a world, you know, let's put my technical background and your background and talent together and really come up with a solution for this. And I was like, I don't know if I should work with my husband. Like, we're already together a lot. Is this going to be too much? I was pretty nervous about it, but he talked me into it and it's been incredible. I don't have a single complaint about it. So that's kind of how Ad Astra came to be.
And when was that? When did you guys start Ad Astra?
4.5 years ago. Does that sound about right, Brian?
Yeah, it was in 2019. I'd say full steam ahead was kind of the fall of 2019.
Okay, that's really when I think we may look back and say that's like sort of a part of the time around the inflection point when space really took off in sort of in many ways, I guess. That
coincidence? I think not.
Okay. But my next question, I think you already partly answered it, Seiko. It's so you clearly saw the market demand. You were mentioning people leaving SpaceX, founding those startups, and basically looking for people. So you saw a specific demand you wanted to serve.
Absolutely. It appeared to us that everybody was looking for, you know, the top 1%, the A players. And one, they can be really hard to find, then they can be hard to contact, and then they can be hard to, right? You got to really reel them in and show them what you're building is something special.
And so what kind of roles are you guys looking for? So for example, like you already mentioned technical, so I assume technical roles is a given, but also like say non-technical roles. You know, I remember I was once browsing the job board at SpaceX and there was really like literally everything on there up to and including like the barista for the internal coffee bar, which by the way, I love the internal coffee bar at SpaceX. Is it non-technical roles as well? Is it all sorts of functions? Is it all sorts of levels? Like for example, do you guys even look for like board members? Like what's the scope here?
Yeah, great question. So typically people are coming to us when they need to hire a really technical leader on their team. So I think there's a pretty big gap in the industry on being able to find and hire like department heads at early stage startups, someone who can do the technical work from day one and really own it and drive it forward at a high level, and then also can grow a department as the company begins to scale. And so I think that's like probably the single most like highest value place that we step in, but we also are working on highly technical individual contributor roles and definitely executive leadership roles, co-founders, founders, C-suite and down. So typically anything in that technical vertical, but especially once we're established with a company, it's not uncommon for them to be like, hey, can you help me hire our first recruiter or an ops person? Or, you know, so we can take on a lot of different things, but kind of the core function of what we do is within that engineering vertical.
And so I got to ask, because Brian, you were mentioning your own story and how you graduated and then you had the chance to work at SpaceX and you were like, oh, that's a lot cooler than working at Boeing. But don't like startups face the same problem that like, I don't know, let's say you are, some sort of new reaction wheel startup, and I don't want to pick on the reaction wheel guys, I'm going to get in trouble. But anyway, just as an example. And then like, how can they compete like in terms of coolness with like, oh, you got to work for SpaceX? What's your advice there to startups?
We're going to startup compete with SpaceX specifically on talent.
Some of the SpaceX / Blue Origin, anybody brain. Else you consider cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, the big things that a startup can offer that like an early stage startup that these larger companies just can't is a larger percentage of ownership of the company. And so that can mean literally in share value, like getting in early and having higher equity, sometimes even single digits of percentage points if you get in early enough. And then, but also you can own a larger percentage of what the company is doing. So SpaceX, even though a large organization, still offers a lot of ownership, and that's very much the culture. But at the end of the day, you're still a very small percentage of like what is being done on the company scale. And a startup allows you to like have your fingerprints directly on like the major results of the company. And so that's just really different. And there's also a lot of ability to rise the ranks and grow with the company. Maybe you get in at one of those head of role, or you're an individual contributor, but you crush it. It's very, very easy to say, great, let's keep that promotion going and add more responsibility. So I think those are really, really important. Plus, I mean, having a really unique and great idea and being really clear on how you communicate what your company is doing and what that idea is, that is going to be so critical in competing against these larger companies. If a candidate comes to you with some interest, but they don't really understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, or how you're doing it, and why it's really, really special, it's going to be really hard to get that person to close and hire enough talent to do what you need to do.
But I suspect that's a great answer, but I suspect that's also the other way around, right? Because, like, you know, if you're maybe a person who used to be at SpaceX, or let's take the more extreme example, you're a person who used to be at Boeing, right? And then maybe, you know, I don't know, you got laid off, or you were kind of sick of Boeing or something, right? And then you're considering going to that small reaction wheel startup, and then maybe they have a really cool story. Sorry, but I guess you also have to make sure that person understands that the startup culture can be completely different, right? Like less clear reporting lines, less clear scope, right? And I assume there's some people who are, you know, suited for that, but other people who are not, right? Like, how do you help them suss that out? How do you suss that out, right? Because if you place the wrong person with the wrong organization, that's the worst outcome for everyone, right?
Yeah, it's such a great, this is such a great conversation for us to be having. And you know, especially new founders, this is a key piece that we want to walk through with them and really lean into, like, we have to pay attention to this. So some of the things that you just mentioned are great for us to dig into. Yes, people are looking to leave Boeing, believe it or not, right now, right? They're coming to us and saying, hey,
incredible.
Who would guess? They're coming to us and they're like, hey, I'm really interested in joining a startup, right? And so from that point, there are conversations that we need to have with the candidate, one, to help them understand if that's really what they would want, right? Is it sounds exciting and fun, and maybe it sounds scary to be where you are right now. Let's talk about how different this is going to be at a startup. When we're looking kind of from the startup's perspective about candidates to consider, some of the things that we want to look at is, yes, the job title and the resume of somebody who's working at a Boeing or another one of these kind of legacy organizations may look like a strong candidate for a startup, but the breadth of technical domain that they have is so different, right? So some at these Boeings, at these large organizations, there are entire teams and the specialization is incredible. We still need the depth of knowledge for these startups, but you're also going to, you know, you're not going to have six people working on one part with you and you have one specific specialization. Like, you are responsible for a much wider breadth of the work of your technical scope. And you also, the culture that you were talking about, right? Being able to, you aren't having your priorities spelled out for you. There aren't people handholding. You're gonna, at a startup, you're gonna see a problem and you're going to need to come up with proposed solutions, right? Go get scrappy to figure out how you're gonna make these solutions come to life, and then maybe go to your supervisor and say, hey, this is what I'm doing. Like, let's turn it over tomorrow, right? Where that cycle is much longer. There's a lot more red tape at these legacy organizations. So some of the things that we'll listen for, and if you're at a legacy organization, please don't use these answers to fool people, because you really want to answer authentically so that we make sure you end up in the right place, right? If we're interviewing somebody from Northrop or a Boeing, and we hear, like, this is moving so slow, I'm going to go crazy. Like, I need a faster pace. It takes forever to get things done. If that's their experience, there's a chance that now a startup isn't going to rock them, right? And if they're kind of like, yes, the pace is great at these other organizations, then being at a startup, it's going to feel like chaos.
in terms of the job seeking side, so since we're talking about that, besides the stuff we already talked about, is there any other, you know, advice you like to give people who come to you looking for jobs?
Yeah, for sure. I think that we want candidates to be really, really honest in what they want, what they is a really good fit for them, and just be really truthful and brutally honest in that interview process. Like Seiko was alluding to, like being a little like bending the truth and kind of lying about how what your experience is or what you're looking for, it's not actually going to help you in the long run, and it's only going to make things worse. And so be really, do a lot of introspection and be really sure about what is it that I want to be doing? What environment am I most successful in? And be ready to speak to that. And I also think that there's a lot of potential for candidates to do more on the company evaluation side, especially with early stage startups. Like, how are you deciding that this is the company you want to work at? There's a lot of startups out there, and only 10% of them actually do what they want to do. So how are you doing your part to end up in the 10%? How are you evaluating their track record of success and hitting their goals? Are you assessing their founders and their leaders and what they're great at and how they can hire and fundraise? I think these things are super important. And a lot of times candidates are only thinking about the interview process as that they're being interviewed. But in reality, like, you're also interviewing the company, and you want to make sure that you're going to be at the right place and that will be successful.
Yeah, I think that is a super interesting and important thing you mentioned. And I was going to ask you about that. Like, what should job seekers be asking the companies? I know we could probably talk hours for that, but is there sort of, I don't know, two or three top things that spring to mind?
Yeah, I think, you know, most startups have a really interesting, cool idea. So to me, that's like part of it, but it's more about how are you going to execute that idea? And I think the biggest ways you do that is by looking at the company's leadership, especially early stage. Are the leaders able to speak clearly to their vision and be able to use that vision to both fundraise and hire exceptional talent? And do they have a great head on their shoulders and roadmap for how to move forward? Like, if the leaders have that early on, there's a much higher probability of success. But if they can't get the right funding, they can't get the right people, they don't have a good plan, I mean, it's pretty obvious it's not not likely to work. And you need to be bought into those things in that leadership, on that leadership team at an early stage startup.
How much sort of pre-filtering do you guys may do on both sides? So both with the candidates before you put them in front of companies, but also companies before you put them in front of candidates, right? Because, you know, Brian, what you're saying there, right? In the worst case scenario, you could have, I don't know how early you start stage versus companies, but let's say there's some company before the first round, right? And you place somebody, and then it's not uncommon. The company may say like, well, you know, we can really only pay you after we raise the first money, and then it never happens. And everybody is kind of annoyed. And yeah, how much pre-filtering?
It's a great question. It depends a little bit. We don't have the exact same formula for each of the companies that we work with. So we have a few different ways that we are getting plugged in with companies. Some we're doing a lot of our own research on what startups are popping up and who we're most interested in working with. We don't want to saturate the space startup market, so we want to be highly selective with who we work with, both because we understand that we're connecting incredibly, you know, the top talent with these roles. We want to make sure that we have the best positions to offer candidates, and because we can't saturate the market, because we frankly need companies to pull from, right? We don't pull from our clients. So we also are connected sometimes through our VC partners who have insights into the organizations, and they say, hey, this is a great company. They also have background references for us. So we establish really strong relationships with some of these VC firms who we've worked with a number of their portcos, and it's kind of a no-brainer, right? They're able to see the quality of our work and then refer us. Sometimes we are going through in-depth pitch decks and asking a lot of in detailed questions. And sometimes we're able to gather enough information, you know, without going kind of digging in deep to pitch decks. But we generally have a pretty comprehensive view of who the organization is, what their goals are. Do we believe in their tech? Do we believe in the team? It has happened multiple times that organizations have come to us, and although the tech is pretty cool, we don't think that they yet have the team to get them there and to be able to share their vision. So we dig into that on the company side. And then on the candidate side, we are doing a technical interview that's a lot more than just asking kind of like, yeah, how many years of CAD experience do you have, right? We're really peeling the onion. We're really understanding what they have personally done, not just been in the room for, what success they've had, you know, what's their track record? Are they somebody who's already had a big success, or are they somebody that we think is really on their upswing to making their mark in the industry? And we do a cultural interview where we're trying to get a deep understanding of what makes this person tick, what motivates them. We use that information not only to ensure that we're matching them with the right role maybe today, but we're also developing a pretty robust database so that we know who people are in the industry. They say, hey, you know, I'm in LA now, but man, one day I'd really love to get to the East Coast, or, you know, in 5 years, I'd really love to move my family and I to the East Coast. And we're tracking 5 years from now, right? We know what people want, when they're going to want it, what kind of makes up the personalities of these people, so that we're able to be looking out for them even when that time spans years.
Yeah, that makes sense, that you're sort of gaining this knowledge over time and building like a franchise value, which is, yes, frankly, value for every side. Those interviews, the technical, the cultural you mentioned, is that sort of like live or written, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's live. So we're conducting, phone interviews and getting kind of all that information. And an interesting piece that I think it's fun to talk about is the cultural piece, right? There's some things where we're screening people, kind of going, okay, this is either a startup person now or not. And yes, people can become later on, maybe, right? We can have that conversation. But there are some pieces where we're going, I don't think this person's going to be a great fit for a startup. And we can, you know, give them that insight as well. The other piece is, like, companies have cultures, and they aren't necessarily, like, they aren't things that we necessarily have a judgment for. There's not good or bad. It's not right, the right way or the wrong way. It just is. It's a unique culture. And there might be an incredible technical professional who would be a great fit at company A and a terrible fit at company B. And that doesn't, there's no judgment on any of those three players, right? It doesn't mean that company A is bad. Doesn't mean that the professional is bad. It just means that the culture wouldn't fit. And so that's a big piece of what we're leaning in and looking for. An easy example of that to point to is, you know, conflict resolution. There are some leadership teams that want to, like, they want to have meetings where people are like yelling and standing up in the meetings and really fighting for their point. And that's something that's appreciated, and that's a value at the organization. And we may talk to people who are pretty conflict averse, who are happy to, like, calmly talk things out, but that would be incredibly jarring for them. And again, it's not good or bad either way. It just is what it is. And we want to make sure that we're matching people in environments that will fit well for them.
That makes a lot of sense. By the way, the just small anecdote, the reason I was asking whether it's that those interviews are written or in person. So one thing that recently happened to in our recruiting, like, sometimes we come up with this, what we think are really smart questions that we send to all candidates. And then I think it was just a few months ago, like, I took the time to personally read through some of these answers. And I was like, oh, this is a smart answer. And then I was like, five candidates on, it was like virtually the same answer. And then, like, another three, I was like, it was virtually the same answer. I was like, wait a minute. And I put the question into ChatGPT, and I was like, that's the answer. And then I was like, okay, I guess the good thing is these candidates are using modern tools. But on the other hand, I don't know if you guys across anything sort of like the modern technology changing the recruiting process already.
That's really funny. And it is, like, what we can catch, it's different because it's live, but what we can catch sometimes is you hear somebody go, like, let me think about that. Let me
and then you hear the keyboard clicking.
Right? think faster, right? Or, you know, they go on mute and you're like, okay, well, we know what's happening here. And right, the question that comes into play is, okay, maybe there's a little dishonesty happening there. We gotta make sure we're tracking that and, you know, maybe call it and see if they'll answer on the nose and be like, yeah, I'm using the tools at my disposal to be able to give you the best answer. And then,
yeah,
you know,
which is good, of course.
Great. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So that's absolutely something that we've seen pop up.
Staying with sort of like advice for job seekers. So another question is, so you were mentioning sort of like the candidate pools you can draw on, and you were mentioning other space companies, but is that enough, or don't you have to look at sort of like adjacent, or not even adjacent, maybe even completely different industries? Because I mean, especially on the non-technical side, let's say somebody needs a CFO, they could almost come from anywhere, I suppose. But even on the technical side, let's say it's, I don't know, programming, right? I mean, doesn't have to be another space company, I assume. So to what extent are you guys also drawing from other like non-space industries? That's the first part of the question. And the second part of the question is going to be, if the candidate is somebody who's not yet from, you know, what's sometimes called the space mafia, right? Where we all know each other. What is some advice for them, like how to make transitioning into the, like breaking into the industry easier?
Yeah. And in this case, like the answer to both those questions is kind of the same thing. And that is, if you're not working in the space industry, we at least usually need to see experience with high performing and or safety critical hardware. And so if you're not already in the space industry, but you want to get in the space industry, it can be hard to break into. So start by going after jobs and companies where you get to own like really critical hardware that needs to perform highly and cannot fail, because that is like the key thing that makes the space industry difficult. We want the top talent who the best of the best because of these things. There's not a lot of room for error. And so that's why we're often, if we can look out of the space industry, we're often looking in other mobility industries. Oil and gas tends to have some of that, renewables, clean tech. There are sometimes biomed can work, but it's often a little bit tough. So there are these other adjacent industries that can work, but that's usually the piece that comes up time and time again is the safety critical and high performance.
All right, all nuclear power plant engineers, come to the space.
Yeah, exactly. Though not a lot has happened in the nuclear industry. So there are now some startups doing nuclear, but kind of like many, many years in nuclear, maybe not much has actually been developed in that time. And so we want to also see like high amount of ownership and a lot of progress and like being able to own a full life cycle design and take it from cradle to grave, because a lot of other larger companies or industries, you're just owning a small percent of what's happening and you're not taking it kind of from conception requirements capture into design and analysis, test, build, production. And we want to see people who've done that all the way through. And yeah, it can be hard to break in. You might need to take a decent pay cut, not only because you're coming to a passion-driven industry where people don't make maybe as much money as some of the other industries like tech, but also because you're maybe not starting at as high of a level in this industry as the one you're coming from. And so that often can be a tough thing for people to reconcile, is that they're maybe going to be taking a 20-50% pay cut, like depending on the situation. But it is hard. This is a hard thing. A lot of these earlier stage companies, like they really do want and need people that have fingerprints in space who've like really done this and shown that they've done it. And so it's easy for a company to say, oh, we're okay with other industries. But then when they actually come down to making the hiring decision, we do see that they are much more likely to pick the folks from their industries. And so what we tend to advise is, you know, get your department head, get your senior leaders with some space experience, and make sure that they know how it's done in the industry, or at least have like learned some of these things, and then be willing to hire and train and mentor under that from other industries. There could be a lot of benefit in hiring for you know, diversity of thought and perspective in those environments.
But so, okay, this is obviously now talking about technical roles, right? But so if the ideal requirement really is, obviously it has to be sort of, first of all, a trained person, right, who has a probably like a degree, if not an advanced degree, that's relevant. And then you're talking about having industry experience as well, right? And so historically, the space industry is not that huge, obviously, right? And now we are growing quite a bit, right? And if all goes well, we will continue to grow. So isn't there inevitably going to be a bottleneck? I mean, isn't there a bottleneck already? And then how is that going to get resolved, right? I mean, okay, we can go and drain the old space primes, right? But at some point in time, you're going to hit a wall there as well, I assume.
Yeah, we're definitely already feeling this in the industry. And it's pretty known that we need to do better and we need to be pulling more people in. And I think that once Starship is operational and now the cost to orbit and it goes down another like order of magnitude or more, we're going to see the industry shift even more. There are going to be more and more startups popping up. There's going to be more and more industry and economy in space. And at that point, it's like exceptionally not sustainable to only be hiring internally, because we're going to be making an entirely new economy of a much larger scale. And so what I would love to see happen at that point is that, you know, not only is it going to be cheaper and easier, new business models will open up to space with Starship, but we also need to realize that because it's cheaper, because we're not as mass and volume constrained, we might not need, you know, circling back to the as high of performance, as high of safety critical engineering to get this done. Like the rigor still needs to be there to some extent, but we might need to lower that bar a little bit and be willing to take a little bit more risk. And that will also open up the candidate pool, because we can't just keep looking at the space industry as like this, you know, ITAR regulated, defense heavy, like small safety like industry. It's going to become a whole new economy, and we got to be ready for that and how we approach those problems.
So, okay, just to push back a little bit on that, as a devil's advocate. So I see what you're saying on the launch side, but is that not going to then just basically get transferred into other areas? Okay, so like now the launch is figured out, quote unquote figured out, thanks to Starship, but now we're going to build a whole bunch of private space stations. And obviously they need to be very safe as well, especially if they're crewed, right? Or we're doing like another type of, you know, Earth observation constellation or SATCOM constellations or navigation constellations, right? I mean, isn't there always going to be a need for, isn't there always going to be mission critical hardware? And yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I realize it's a bit controversial to say, oh, let's just like not think about safety as much. And I hear that. And I think that's like fair, right? But at the same time, we need to know which applications of work that we're doing in space like demand the same level or maybe even more rigor, and which types of work don't, you know, where can we continue to work? Where can we take a more consumer electronics approach to space hardware, and where can we not? And I think we need to be thinking about that already today, but especially once Starship is up and running. Otherwise, we're just not going to have the people to be able to do all the things that like will become available at that point.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair comment, right? It's, I mean, correct me if I'm seeing this incorrectly, but it's sort of like, you know, in the old days, we'd have said, oh my God, we built a satellite. It cannot fail, because if you have to launch it again, it's going to be so expensive. Now, like, you know, a Starlink satellite fails. It's like almost like, well, whatever, like, you know, we're sending up another 30 next week.
Exactly. It's like, this is already happening, right? In certain places, and that, you know, we still have to be careful with space junk. We still have to be very careful with human safety. Like, there are still places to be very, very careful. But yeah, we're already seeing this. It's already been a huge step change from 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I just think we're going to see that again. And we like the talent and requirements also are going to have to match that.
And so you mentioned something very interesting there in the middle, because you referenced ITAR, for our listeners who may not know, that's sort of regulations called International Traffic in Arms Regulation, and a lot of space technology is basically restricted by that, because it obviously can be used as military technologies. I mean, obviously rockets are essentially missiles, just to mention the easy example. And so one consequence of that is that I believe in very many U.S. based companies, you basically have to be a U.S. citizen or at least a green card holder, right, to work? Is that
in general, U.S. citizen, green card holder, and there are some protected persons that do qualify. It's pretty rare. And then there are other ways to get around this. SpaceX does it, where you can hire if you go jump through different hoops, but almost no early stage startup like bothers with jumping through those hoops. So it pretty much realistically narrows it down to U.S. citizens and green card holders.
Do you see the bottleneck could ever become so large that some political pressure could amount to maybe change that? Because I mean, you know, I'm speaking as a non-U.S. citizen, right? But somebody who, you know, went to school in the U.S., spent a lot of time there to some extent, is almost patriotic about the U.S. But it seems like we're leaving a lot of talent on the table. It seems like we're missing a chance of draining our adversaries of talent. It just seems, I don't know. And then the counter argument, I guess, that one often hears is like, oh, but they're going to send spies. But it was like, okay, if our counterintelligence is so bad, that's a problem by itself, you know? If you were like invited to congressional testimony, it was like, oh, Ms. Major, like you're a space recruiter, SDA doesn't get its stuff on time. Like, what do you think?
You're Mr. Ryan. What do you have to say? I don't know. It's a great question. I don't have a good answer for it. I'm not sure. I don't really know how those political decisions, are made. And it's above my pay grade.
Yeah, I do think, though, that this is a similar thing that needs to be on the minds of the policy and decision makers. Again, once Starship comes, like as this economy evolves, it's going to start to look more like telecom or automotive and like these other more terrestrial like industries, because the access is just going to change so dramatically, and it's not going to be nearly as exotic. There's going to be all these applications that will not be relevant or like related to being defense. And we are currently, it's just like, oh, yep, we're an ITAR company. Like every space company, yep, we're an ITAR. ITAR, 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 right? And I get why that started that way, but we need to like evolve in that way and be able to recognize when a company is not doing ITAR related work. And then we can kind of, expand the ability for non-green card holders to work on these projects. I mean, when I was studying and gave my master's at Michigan, like the number of really, really excellent engineers there that don't have their green card. And so they're doing research, they're kind of staying in academia or like not really getting into the fields they would really love to get into because they don't have it. Like there's a lot of untapped potential in folks, like both like domestically and like you mentioned, being able to pull these folks from overseas and bring them to the US, you know, there could have more aliens with extraordinary abilities is a classification.
Exactly, which are, and I went to school in the US, I've seen those people as well. I guess a related question, if there was like an extraordinary person that could be very valuable for a big space company, have you seen examples of where they, I don't know, get the green card quicker or something like this? Or in your experience, they just go through the same process? And I'm partly asking because we have a lot of international listeners.
We haven't really seen that yet, unfortunately. It's like really pretty black and white, especially for these early stage companies. I know SpaceX has ways to, you know, get the right paperwork to make it happen. But in general, it's pretty darn black and white, and you got to figure out a way to get a green card, and then now you become eligible. And it's like a really sad truth. Sega,
I was going to say the other piece that makes it like answering that question a little bit complicated is so much of what happens between submitting paperwork to get a green card and actually having it is completely unknown. When we're talking to candidates, sometimes we have really exceptional candidates who are like, hey, I'm in process to get my green card. I might have it at some point in the next 5 years, could be next week. No idea, right? And so it's really hard for us to gauge what speeds that up. I will say very anecdotally, there's, you know, a pilot shortage in the US. And as a pilot, I'm a general aviation pilot, my flight instructor got his green card. It was something insane. I want to say it was like a 2-month turnaround.
Wow.
So yeah. And that to me felt suspicious. In a good way, right? Of just like, it seems like that was expedited because they want you to be able to work as a pilot, right? But maybe I'm wrong. I have no idea. I'm making a lot of assumptions there.
So that sounds like you guys should open the Ad Astra pilot school subsidiary to kind of create additional right. funnel of like international space talent that gets quick green cards.
That's
and it helped that I think he did
get your general aviation.
And I think it helps. I think he does, like this case, he does have like a U.S. citizen. His wife's a U.S. citizen, I believe,
okay.
which is why Sega always makes a joke of like, well, if you're international, you know, set your dating profile to the United States. That's like your best way to expedite getting your green card.
That is my joke. So. I say set, when people ask, how do I get my green card? I say, set your Tinder to the U.S. But fall in love. I'm not saying to do anything shady, right? I'm just saying if you're going to date someone. Right.
Yeah, everybody remember the movie Green Cat from like whatever 30 years ago. So I'm dating myself. But okay, I think I've beaten the nationality sort of passport green card issue to death. It's just because we have listeners in 100 countries. So I know people are interested in this. Let me ask you an ever so slightly related question, which is so we're talking about maybe international people as candidates. The other thing that's personally bugging me, and I think it's bugging many people, is just the gender imbalance. In the space sector, do you guys have any view on how we could, do you guys see it improving? Do you guys have any sort of views how we can help improve that?
It's a great question. Some of the things that we're doing to focus on that is partnering with programs that really make space feel accessible and like girls and women belong, right? So I say girls because some of the programs that we're partnering with are for girls, right? They're for like 7 to 14-year-olds. But it's really about planting that seed and making them feel like there's a path to this space that is for them, right? So that they're not kind of arriving and going, okay, well, I'm in classes with all boys and I'm it's fine, but it the feeling of belonging really helps.
Yeah, just to add to that a little bit, like this is not just a problem in industry, like it's already a problem in like college and university. Like it was 10% female roughly my graduating class, and so it's like already such a problem so early that we have to fix it so early.
I did a master's degree in machine learning, and I don't know how many seminars I had where it was only men. It was like shocking.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's really cool point that you two are bringing up is that in education, and I think kind of graduating, to be an aerospace engineer, for example, I think the number is like 11.4% are female. And the stats that I was reading, I wasn't able to find. So don't quote me on this. I was looking for the stat before this conversation. I wasn't able to find it quickly. But what my memory is that from 25 to 35 year olds, now that drops almost in half. And I think what we're seeing, right, is childbearing age when people are deciding to have families, and it's removing a large portion of women from our industry. So some of the things that I think that companies on the company side can be doing is, you know, having representation. So again, creating that belonging, having people in roles where, you know, if a woman's interviewing on a team, she's not interviewing exclusively with, on a team of men, right? She doesn't feel like, okay, I'm only presenting to men. It feels like, okay, there are women at this organization and women in leadership positions that I'm able to have some, you know, community with. And also, if we want to fight against that drop when women kind of hit the age where they're having families, is creating work environments that support people that are also having children and moving into that stage of life.
I was going to ask about it, but I guess it's the bias is a bit bigger companies, right? Because I can see SpaceX having like, in-house childcare, breastfeeding stage. I don't know, like all sorts of like infrastructure. But if you're sort of a 5-people seed stage startup, I guess it's probably more complicated.
Right. It's probably more complicated. You probably don't have the space for childcare. And one of the pieces that just is tough is like a 5-person startup. Let's say one of them, does have, needs additional support and flexibility for childcare. That does put a lot of pressure on the company. And I as a mother and a woman, like I respect that. I respect that is a lot of pressure, and that does put everybody involved in a tough situation.
Okay, fair enough. But it's great to hear you guys are sort of thinking about this topic as well. So as we're sort of slowly coming towards the end here, I'd like to do a quick sort of almost like a rapid fire round. And the thought here is that you guys obviously, I think, have a very good overview, since it's your job, of the space jobs market. And just to see if there's any sort of interesting trends. So I'm just going to ask you 4 or 5, basically topics, and see whether you guys have any sort of interesting data, trends, things you want to highlight. First thing would be any particularly interesting, subsectors of space that you think are really hot right now for job seekers, like SATCOM, EO, launch, whatever.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a disinterest in launch for sure. Consolidation and of these small launch vehicles has and like SpaceX's success and kind of the impact on the environment has led to a disinterest in launch. People are really interested in clean tech in general, but they still want to stay in space. So I think if your space company has a legitimate like clean tech angle, that's been great. And then I don't know if this is necessarily huge, but in general, we've seen a big shift in interest in defense from a couple years ago. Since Russia invaded Ukraine, we felt that we've seen a lot of candidates and also startups pop up that are trying to do more on the defense side, whereas people used to be a lot more hesitant in there. So there's been shifts there.
By the way, sort of opening up a bracket, since you're mentioning sort of launch being disinteresting, I guess we had a number of already some failures, right? Like Virgin Orbit, Astra is not going so well. That obviously also, I guess, has released some people back into the job market. From what you've seen, I assume they should all be able to find jobs again, because from all I heard, there's a sort of demand and a bottleneck.
Yeah, I think that when we see layoffs within the space industry, those folks tend to land on their feet pretty well. What doesn't tend to relate as well as layoffs in other industries or in tech or something, those don't tend to have too big of an impact on our work or on our industry. But yeah, when there is a company that fails or has a lot of layoffs or anything like that, we do see that those individuals tend to land on their feet pretty well. I just wanted to also like compliment our industry, because it's been really fun to see. You mentioned the space like mafia, everyone knows each other. Everyone's making spreadsheets of all these candidates, and everyone's like referring everybody and hosting career days and all these like really great things. And so there definitely is a sense of community that, hey, you're one of us and just didn't work out with your company. Like, let's get you somewhere.
Yeah, I totally agree. I was impressed when, like, for example, Virgin Orbit happened, the like number of LinkedIn messages in this vein you mentioned, sort of like, come into my database or come to this event. It's been really sort of heartwarming almost. The second rapid fire question was sort of anything specific you've seen in terms of roles, like functional roles, qualifications, skills that are being hired for?
I wouldn't say that there are many trends in the functional roles. I haven't seen anything that, Brian, just jump in if you've got a kind of a different perspective, but yeah, no, I wouldn't say any
GNC
trend.
Has been brutal, but besides GNC,
Yeah, that is interesting. We had a wave of a lot of people looking for skilled technical GNC engineers who also had the capacity to lead, And we found there are a lot of them. The really skilled ones we found were demanding very high salaries, you know, which is fair, and also really wanted hybrid or remote work environments. And it felt like everybody and their mom wanted this profile, and it was really hard to find them.
Okay, I said it was a quick fire round, and I'm totally destroying the quick fire aspect here, but I'm going to open up another bracket. So if there was some situation like that where the bottleneck is so tight and it may only be a few people, and somebody is especially in sort of in a more leading overseeing role, is there some possibility that you could even move away from a traditional 100% one job model and somebody could kind of become, I don't know, like a one third consultant to three companies, or is that not realistic?
It's possible. I mean, yeah, it's totally possible. And it's a conversation that we definitely will entertain. I think that most founders and most startup leadership, they're like, we want 150% of you, right? Not 30%. We need you bought into our mission. We need your blood, sweat, and tears. We need you to breathe this company. Yeah, if you need a kind of a consultant or a fractional individual as a band-aid, I think that makes sense. But we do see a breakdown but it is a creative solution, and yeah, nothing's weird in the startup world, right?
And so the next question was on sort of any regional trends, and I'd like to ask that from both perspective, both the job seeker as well as the company. So for job seekers, assuming people are flexible, right? Job seeker, if you're flexible, why don't you move to whatever the right answer is, maybe Colorado, because there's a lot going on. And then, but also from the founder perspective, like, hey, founder, if you're flexible, why don't you open up in, I don't know, Tennessee, because there's some unexpectedly good talent pool and salaries are cheaper or something like that.
Yeah. In general, I think on both sides, things are easier if you're in one of the talent hubs. If you're, I would say LA more or less continues to dominate and has the most talent, but you know, Seattle and Denver and even the Bay Area has some pretty good talent. These places tend to be much easier to not only hire for your startup, but also if you're looking to make a change, like you have a lot of options nearby. And so in general, that tends to be the way to go. There are other areas that kind of are next tier that do okay, but you usually want to be just in those areas. It makes things a lot easier. I think the exceptions to that are if you have some really specific skill set that you're going to hire a bunch of, sometimes you might want to co-locate next to like where that industry happens to be located, if it's not this like the broader space industry, or even where the best universities are for that work, because that can make it easier if that's going to be your critical skill set. And if you can be a little more flexible with your other skills, then it can make sense. But usually if you're in the more lower cost of living areas, it's great in theory, but then it ends up being pretty hard to hire for. And I don't know, I haven't done like a full study to see it. Like, do you actually save enough money on salaries to justify that?
Yeah, fair enough. And then the last of the quickfire questions on any trends would be sort of in the compensation packages you're seeing in the space sector, whether there's anything interesting going on.
Yeah, we, it's been fairly stable. We were seeing a lot more kind of variability, I think, in 2022, maybe early 2023. And then we started to see things really kind of feel like they were leveling out. We do see solid bases even for early stage startups. So kind of less founders hoping that we can really get people to bank like completely on equity, or you know, in massive part on equity with a really low base salary, and really kind of try and have the salary hold its own. So yeah, we still do see that only later stage companies with lots of cash and less equity are offering the high base comp, right? So we're still looking for maybe like the very, very top of market professionals for kind of average cash compensation. So there is a gap there, but it feels more reasonable. And something else that's probably worth mentioning here that we do see repeatedly and think that there is a trend here is we think that startups could do a better job of explaining equity, explaining what the value of equity in compensation packages is, right? And we're not saying you're making promises, you're guaranteeing anything. So just like spell it out, what it is and what is being offered, because I think we skip over that piece a lot and kind of say, you'd get, you know, this many options. And then the conversation is a little bit over. Go ahead.
Yeah, but it's like I was going to ask you about that because, I mean, so as you know, when I don't do this, my main job is I'm actually a space venture capitalist, right? And so I know all of these early stage companies. And for the moment, for better or worse, they're still mostly technical founders. And they themselves don't know anything about options most of the time. So how can they explain it to anyone, right? It's like the blind leading the blind. So my question here isn't that, don't you have the same experience? And then isn't it, can guys like you help them with that? Sort of like even simple questions like, oh, I'm hiring employee number 5. And like tell them, well, this is kind of a typical range of equity that employee number 5 can get. And this is how it works and blah, 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 blah.
Such a great question. Gosh, you're this is so fun. Yes. So we have that conversation on both sides. We have that conversation often with founders and they go, this is what we're thinking about. Right? Is this right? Right. And now we have so many data points that we can pull from in our own data set. And Brian does a great job of talking founders through it and go, hey, this is kind of what's typical on this side. And this would be a great way to kind of explain this to candidates. And then on the other side, I mean, I call it like equity therapy, right? Like, there are so many conversations where, you know, a candidate frankly doesn't want to ask some of the questions that they have about equity to their potential employer, thinking the questions sound dumb, right? But they don't know the answer. Maybe they've even had, you know, they have equity at other companies, but they've just never really thought through this, which is such a key point that you were just making of the blind leading the blind. And Brian will take, you know, an hour and make a spreadsheet and go, hey, I'm like, there are no promises here, right? But let's say like, we know the probability of startup success. If they make it big, this is what it would look like. If they don't, this is what it would look like. If they, you know, make it halfway through, this is kind of so just to kind of build a mental model of like, what does this equity mean? What is the potential of it if we're successful and really try to, paint a picture of it. Brian, take it away.
Yeah, there's a lot to say here, but I think just to add to it a little bit more is I don't think founders are giving, like, we have technical founders who love talking numbers in general, but then they don't give useful numbers to their engineers that they're hiring who also want to know numbers. Like just saying, oh, you're going to have like 100K in stock options. That is not very useful information and definitely doesn't do much to sell anything. You want to be able to try to tell a story about what some of these reasonable outcomes can be and like what is the cash that will be. You can calculate these things. And yes, there's a ton of uncertainty with it, but it's better than nothing. And I've seen very few founders and very few companies like be ready to talk through those outcomes and like give, say, yeah, this could be worth millions per year. And there's a very realistic path to that outcome. And there's also these risks and there's also this possible outcome, you know, so on and so forth.
So a related question on that. How do you, if at all, how do you help protect your clients on, you know, having their own employees hired away from, because I mean, it's not uncommon that you may have a scenario like maybe it's a seed stage startup, the Series A is taking more time, people start getting frustrated, right? Do you step in and try to give, you know, any sort of advice on what people should be doing, founders?
You know, leading well, supporting your team and yet treating them well and being moving aggressively toward exciting goals. We don't do a ton on the side of kind of coaching for long-term retention, especially when poaching's going on, but we have a lot of insights to it, right? Most of it is about taking care of people and chasing after goals that are really exciting.
Yeah, I guess that is an obvious answer. Take care of your people. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, gosh, we could be speaking for hours, I can already tell, but We do have to wind down here, so I'm going to ask you some sort of final questions. So if people, I assume you're very happy to hear from people from both sides, companies as well as startups, absolutely. And what's the best way to just go to your website and is that the easiest way of getting in touch?
Our website is great, or reaching out via LinkedIn.
Okay, cool. And we'll put those links in the episode notes, so it's easy
Perfect.
For people.
One other thing I want to make sure to mention, we'll send you this link as well, is Brian wrote a great article on hiring legacy versus startup talent. And that was kind of what we started this conversation talking about. And it's got some really great information in there. So I'll shoot that link over as well in case that's interesting for anybody to look at.
Terrific. Yeah, we'll include that link as well. And then I guess moving sort of towards more general questions, I guess particularly for Brian, since you spent quite a bit of time in the space sector, including at some very big players, what are you generally watching with interest in the space sector?
Yeah, I mean, Starship, duh. Like, how can you not watch those launches and be excited about the future with Starship coming down the pike? For me, I'm also pretty excited by lunar missions and having us like kind of reestablish that and seeing what comes to be on the lunar surface. In-space manufacturing is really interesting. Cool stuff that Varda recently accomplished has been really fun to watch. And then space stations. I mean, how can you not get excited about seeing more humans in space and more companies attacking this? I'm excited to see how those business models develop and how it actually comes to be. But yeah, that's hard to not be excited about.
Agreed. And then totally different question from what I usually ask, but since you guys are parents of small kids, is there any thought you guys are already giving to sort of like how to bring space into your kids' lives?
I mean, we have to like beat it away with a stick, frankly. Our whole world is filled with you know, space inspiration. Our dog has a space name, and we've got astronauts all over the house, and you know, he's got space themed. I think he can name all the planets already. Our 3-year-old can name all the planets already and knows, you know, which ones are giant gas planets, et cetera. So it's, you know, it's very natural. It's in his blood and his awareness. And I think, you know, I, as his mother, I keep telling him like being an astronaut's really boring, but space work is very exciting, right? Want to make sure he doesn't try to go to Mars. I'd let him, but you know, scary. So yeah, those are some of the ways that it's all around all the time.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess it is full immersion. I mean, this is an audio podcast, but behind Brian there's like a board with I think something like 40 mission patches. So
yeah,
there we go.
Yeah,
our entire our lower level have... of our house, the entire level is just decked out in like space stuff. We got an astronaut on one wall, you know, some more abstract art on a couple other walls, some really cool artistic plaques of like Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo. So yeah, you're pretty well immersed if you come to our house.
You guys are going to have the coolest kids' birthday parties. You know, everybody's going to love it.
Yeah, our oldest son's middle name is Neil, and second is Jetson, right, with a nod to airplane. So it's everywhere.
Fair enough. Point taken. they're getting indoctrinated. And so our traditional final question is on science fiction. You guys like, if ever you guys like science fiction, I really hope yes. And if so, what are some favorites?
Is it too cliche? Is everybody's answer Interstellar? That's my favorite.
It's many people. We actually did a, when we hit 100 episodes, we ran statistics and sort of really predictably, I think number 1 and 2 were Star Wars and Star Trek. Interstellar was, I think, definitely top 10. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll go, you know, Ad Astra. No, I'm just kidding. I hated that movie. That we had the name so of our,
was that before or after you guys picked the name for the cup?
After we had the business running for like a year, year and a half, we're like, cool. Like, we know it's not like the most unique phrase or possible name in the industry, but we're like feeling good about it. And like Ad Astra is now plastered like everywhere. We're so excited to watch it. And then I was just so let down and frustrated by the whole thing that was not excited about the brand association there for a year or so while it was more mainstream, but. Yeah, no, not at Astra.
Okay, fair enough. So just to be clear to everyone, you guys did not name the company after the movie.
Okay. Yeah, you guys watching? Are you guys watching the three body problem?
No, where is that? Where do we watch that?
Netflix. Yeah, Netflix.
All right, we will be. We're about to be.
I highly recommend. Okay, guys, it's been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for what you're doing. I think it's at this point in time in the industry and going forward, it's a really important thing. So, you know, thank you for that.
Thank you so much. It's been such a fun conversation, and it's a joy to get to share thoughts and ideas with you. You're a blast, and you're doing very cool things in the industry.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate your time and having us on.
Well, that's it for another nominal episode of the Space Business Podcast. If you like this podcast, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform, such as iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter at podcast_space. Also consider supporting us at www.patreon.com/spacebusinesspodcast. If the podcast got you interested in learning more about the business opportunities in the space economy, check out my new online course on space entrepreneurship on udemy.com. The link is in the episode description. Lastly, if you have any feedback, including ideas for guests, and that may include yourself if you have an exciting space story to tell, or interested in being a sponsor, drop us an email at spacebusinesspodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to seeing you for the next episode.